Good evening, everyone. You're listening to Spiritually Speaking with Reverend Jen and Rebecca. This is Reverend Jennifer Kotler, and my co-host Rebecca Stevens is on the air.
Hello,
this
everyone.
Is Monday, December 22nd. Yes, it's 3 days before Christmas, and we are coming to you on a pre-recorded show. So there won't be a call-in feature tonight. We look forward to talking to you every second and fourth Monday of the month, and tonight is December 22nd, and we have a special guest with us. So I'm going to turn the show over to Rebecca and have her introduce our guest.
Thank you so much, Jen, and good evening, everyone. It's so great to be talking to Lindsay Nye. Lindsay is a student at the Union Theological Seminary, where I am also a student. She comes to us from a really, really fascinating career pre-seminary, but also what she's been working on in seminary has been really interesting. And so welcome, Lindsay. Thank you so much for
doing
this.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. So the first thing I want to talk about is what I'd like to get into is that Lindsay is a very talented and sort of very grateful artist. And Lindsay, I would love for you to tell us just sort of like, you know, how your, I guess, journey to come to seminary and then your desire to sort of use art and creativity in your biblical studies.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for the compliment. That's very generous coming from such a good musician herself.
thank you.
And, yeah, it has been a really long journey. I mean, I think I can kind of originally trace it back to just this love of art and creative expression when I was a kid, and that was always my favorite outlet. Whenever you asked me, you know, what did I like to do, I would say, oh, I like to make stuff. And someone once told me that, you know, the thing that you loved most to do as a child should be the thing that you aspire to do with your career. And that was told to me at a point in time when my career wasn't feeling so fulfilling. And I think that that was one of those seeds that was planted that kind of started orienting me to this current path that I'm on. When I graduated from college, I worked for the Obama campaign and then was hired as a political appointee in the Obama administration. I worked for a very big bureaucratic agency. The work was very exciting and very challenging for some time. And then things started to get a little bit complicated. There were a number of my managers left the office, and I was kind of in a very stagnant professional position, and I just realized that, you know, I had joined public service and did political organizing because I really wanted to work with people. That was really important to me. Service leadership was really important to me. But I kind of, you know, I was working at this desk job from, you know, 9 to 6, writing really long policy papers, you know, that were being hacked apart and discarded. And actually, you know, I became very depressed. I just felt like I had really lost my way and that I was really pursuing these professional goals that I had kind of just been given by other people and that I hadn't really developed myself necessarily. And this started me on this kind of spiritual and personal journey where I was trying to just get you know, back on track. And it I had this kind of revelation one day. I was sitting in the Unitarian Universalist Church, All Souls in Washington, D.C., and the preacher that day was giving a sermon on vocation, and it was one of those aha moments where I, you know, it was just like eureka, like, oh, you know, maybe my vocation can be within a faith context. And it was only a matter of months before I figured out, you know, I talked to a few minister friends, and, you know, they pointed me in the direction of Union. They said, you have to go to Union. Union is the place for you. And I didn't really know a whole lot about it, but I just kind of took their word for it. And I packed up all my stuff, and I moved to New York City a few months later and enrolled at Union. And, you know, 2.5 years later, I can say it's been the most rewarding experience I've ever had. And Union is a really, really special place. And part of, or, you know, maybe even the biggest part of what has made it so special to me is that Union gave me the space to become an artist again, to go back to that child that I was, you know, that loved creative expression so, so much. And no one challenged me, you know, when I, you know, in the kind of negative contextual way, like no one was like, well, you can't do art, it's impractical.
Right.
It was like, yes, clearly you are an artist, do art, you know, it's important
wow.
to you, and you're good at it. And so I think it was first as kind of personal, you know, reclaiming of art as my vocation. And after I got kind of comfortable, you know, being in that role again, I started to really sense and explore how art can be used in a collaborative way in groups of people, because I just really started to witness people healing in these collaborative moments where art was really grounded in spirituality. And I do think the two are kind of, you know, embedded in one another, that art is spiritual and spirituality is very creative and artistic.
That's
so that's kind of the impulse behind the work that I've been doing over the last few years.
So can you talk about, so the first 2 years of your work here, you organized and put together a performance of Broadway music and set to biblical texts. And and then you're going to do another project this year, which I'm thrilled to be a part of. But I want, you know, so if you could talk just a little bit about the first 2 years and what that looked like, and then how that sort of morphed into how you're going to do things this year for the performance in the spring, and your thoughts around, or your process, I guess, around putting something like that together in an environment like this.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks for asking about that.
So
I have had some experience in musical theater. I had done a number of productions in high school and college. And really love Broadway and Broadway musicals. And so we were, my entering class at Union is an incredibly talented group of musicians. And we also have a couple of musicians who have been on Broadway. Actually,
mm-hmm.
one woman was just cast in a Broadway production that'll be happening or opening in the spring. So just some really, really amazing talent, and a lot of excitement around Broadway. And this is something that we kind of came together on really early on. And we were all sitting around one evening and talking about how fun it would be just to do a production where we could just sing some Broadway songs, just a lighthearted, you know, performance where we could really showcase our talent and our love for Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And That idea was thrown out, and then, you know, we got kind of into the midst of the crazy semester, and I was actually studying for my Hebrew Bible content final. It was, you know, early December, and I, you know, just to kind of keep myself awake and alert, I was also listening to Broadway musicals, and
wow.
I was reading Genesis. And I had this moment, and I thought, oh, my gosh, there are so many Broadway numbers that could tell the story of Genesis. And I called my friend Kimberly, and I said, hey, I've got an idea. Let's do a Broadway review of the book of Genesis.
I love it.
And it was so funny because I had already put together a song list of maybe about 8 or 9 songs, and I went over to Kimberly's, and we opened a bottle of wine, and I swear to you, we sat there for the next 8 hours. It was like 4 p.m. to midnight, and we wrote this Broadway review, and we kind of we imagined who the cast would be from the people that we knew at the seminary. We were both involved in the choirs here, and so you know, we had an idea of who might sing what parts, and and it ended up turning into this radical reimagining of Genesis through the interpretation of Broadway musicals. I wasn't expecting it. I don't think anyone was expecting it. One of my favorite moments was so we started kind of with the garden, and and we chose this song for Eve to sing to Adam. It's called Unexpected Song. It's from Andrew Lloyd Webber's not very well-known musical called Song and Dance. And and I was actually playing the part of Eve in this number. And we were in rehearsal, and I was singing this song. And I just had this moment of inspiration where I thought, this is not a song from Eve to Adam. This is a song from Eve to God. This is a love song between Eve and God. And it just so happened that we had people playing the character of God on stage. So God was embodied. And in this particular scene, we kind of handed off characters to each other so that everyone had a chance to play. Mm-hmm. And in this particular scene, this woman, Natalie, who is one of these incredible people with Broadway experience, she's a woman of color, is playing God. And I'm playing Eve, who's kind of trying to evade Adam, who's kind of getting in the way of this relationship this love relationship that I have to God. So all of a sudden, you have this text that is going from this really, I mean, there's a kind of a damaging contemporary reading of this text, right, that Eve is disobedient and God punishes humankind because of Eve's actions, and this kind of damns women in perpetuity, right? Yeah. And so, but that's not actually written in the Bible, right? That's our kind of one of our contemporary interpretations of this scene. Instead, we have changed this reading of this text in this moment. So this is about a love between God and Eve. And not only that, but it's a multiracial, queer love between God and Eve. And what kind of possibilities does that open up for the person who's watching this scene or who's even acting in it? We had a number of people come up after the show and say, oh my gosh, like, you totally changed my mind about this particular scene from the Bible, or, oh my gosh, I didn't know church was so cool. We held it in the chapel. We had, some refreshments, and people were like, they couldn't believe that we were doing this in church. And what was really exciting was David Carr, who's a professor at Union and who is a world-renowned biblical scholar, and he's kind of like, if there was a calendar of biblical scholars, like, he would be like Mr. Genesis, right? He did the annotations in the Oxford NRSV, so on
That's
Genesis.
Right.
And he came up to us and he said, I learned things about Genesis tonight. Mm-hmm. Because like the world expert on Genesis told us that he learned about Genesis.
Unbelievable.
So it was just this really, really incredible moment. And we did this all, on a shoestring budget. It was totally student-run and student-supported. And he said, are you going to do this again next year? Because I'd love to be involved, and I'd love to give you some institutional support.
Wow.
And we were like, yeah, absolutely. And so that started us on to the next journey, which we undertook Exodus as our next journey. And it was an incredible production, and we did it with a lot more intention. We had a class where we were doing textual study of the book of Exodus. We were looking at Exodus, you know, from Jewish standpoints, from African American standpoints, from American imperial standpoints.
Mm-hmm.
And we were, you know, trying to understand the book of Genesis from all of these different viewpoints and really do justice to it. And, you know, there were so many incredible moments in that show too. The one that I just wanted to mention. I mean, there's so many, but my particularly favorite moment was the scene of the burning bush, and where God says to Moses, you know, I am that I am, and this kind of like quizzical explanation of the nature of God. Well, there's this really funny and wonderful song from a musical called The Kaju Fall called I Am What I Am. And it's actually, it's a song, I think, about coming out, about being a drag artist, being queer. And we had God sing this song, I Am What I Am. And, you know, it was this, like, vaudevillian, you know, just like outrageous number. We had, you know, we had like magic tricks going on in the background and flashing lights. Wow. And but God sings, you know, so what if I love each feather and each spangle? Why not try to see things from a different angle? Your life is a sham till you can shout, hey world, I am what I am. And the person performing this also happened to be a woman of color who also has a disability. And so to watch someone with these particular life experiences singing this song of radical affirmation of themselves and of their creations, right? Like that just gives such a different feel to that moment. You know, is this God not only, you know, giving this kind of dark and mysterious commentary on God's nature, but is God saying, you know, I love myself and I love all of my creation. And, you know, it gives me chills to think about it. So we've done some really, really cool theological work together. And the second year was, you know, there was a lot more, like we had six directors. There was a lot, you know, kind of a flatter model of direction and acting. So it was, it started to become like a much more communal project that, you know, it kind of started just standing on its own two legs and walking around without me, which was really great.
That was wonderful. Mm-hmm. And so talk about, so you did the first 2 years, I mean, obviously very successful. And I'll just tell the listeners, you know, my experience of this up to this point, which is that I am a new student at Union, so I wasn't in school when these projects were going on. And in fact, last year, when I was taking tours of Union and, you know, discerning whether or not I was going to attend school here, one of the big parts of my decision-making was the fact that people kept talking about this very ambitious student who put together this Broadway review. And you know, and that was such a big, that just spoke very loudly to me that this was a place where people could express themselves artistically. And then, you know, meeting you, you know, this year and sort of putting a face with what I had been hearing about and thinking about in my process to come to seminary. So so that was such a big part of that. And I think it's important to acknowledge that, you know, you certainly had an impact on the cast and the audience, the people involved with the production. You know, there were many other, you know, sort of co-leaders that you had in the production that I think probably learned a lot about putting something like this together. But I mean, it, you know, the effects of something like this have a very, very strong ripple effect. And I think that's the beauty of art, and particularly of performance. These things really stick with people, and especially when we're working with biblical texts that have in the past damaged people and have been interpreted in ways that can be used to oppress entire, you know, demographics. So I just want to, like, lift that up. But also, so when you were telling me about, you know, these projects and the way that you put them together, at the time, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but at the time I had the impression that you were sort of maybe not going to do a project this year. and I will take credit or responsibility for you know, encouraging this to continue, because I think it's such an important part of the way that we educate ourselves biblically. And so can you tell us just about, so you decided to do the project again, and then you have sort of a team that you guys all sort of work together, and that how this is going to change this year, and also how it's going to work into your academic work.
Sure. We were, I think we were a little worn out after 2 years of they're really, really a lot of work, a lot of really fun work. I think the shows were really driven by my entering class, which is now the soon-to-be exiting class, and there's a lot going on in order for us to prepare for graduation and moving into our various ministries.
Right.
So there wasn't as much excitement about doing it again. There were certainly some people who really wanted to do something, and I'm so grateful that the work that we did attracted you. I mean, that alone makes it worth it. It was a really affirming conversation that we had when you told me that factored into your choice to come to Union.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was a little bit feeling kind of personally, not necessarily discouraged, but a little bit kind of quizzical about, okay, like, what is this? How does this keep growing? And how does this keep evolving? And there was a part of me that was still really uncomfortable with a kind of taking on a, like, director's role, like, you know, I'm the director, and I'm going to tell you, like, how to do this art. Obviously it's not quite that dogmatic, but there's still a kind of a hierarchical relationship between cast and director. And I just, the more that I was learning about Jesus and, you know, the early church, I was just thinking, I don't know if this is the way that it should be. And simultaneously, I was also last spring taking this class on improvisation. And it was, you know, listeners might be like, why would you take a class on improvisation at seminary? And it was really wonderful, because there is such deep spirituality in the art of improvisation, because you really, really have to let go. You really, really have to open yourself up to, you know, if you're a Trinitarian, to the Holy Spirit. You have to kind of move your ego out of the way, and really just let what you know in your heart and in your body come forward in improvisation. And so we were learning improvisation in this context of worship, using it in congregations, using it in performance, and I learned all these methodologies for approaching improvisation, and all of these values of improvisation, and practiced a lot. And I had some of the most incredibly spiritual experiences I've ever had, probably the most incredible group spiritual experiences I've ever had in this class, where we did things like danced with each other with our eyes closed.
Wow.
and did this. We did a form of improvisation called contact improvisation, where you, I mean, and it's it happens in a space that's built to be very safe, where you have really wonderful mm-hmm. facilitators. And in contact improvisation, you have two people who are exchanging weight. So you're always touching, and you're always kind of leaning against each other. And it turns into this really incredible dance and really incredible trust exercise. So I was doing that with, you know, people that I didn't necessarily know very well, people that, who were close friends and colleagues. You know, we did some exercises where we stood. This was kind of a peacemaking exercise where we stood almost nose to nose with someone and made uninterrupted eye contact for like 5 minutes.
Oh,
and it's so, I mean, it's so uncomfortable. Oh my gosh. But then you move into this place of incredible connection. And I think that's improvisation. That really encapsulates what improvisation is that you start in this kind of uncomfortable place. You know, you're bringing your baggage, you're bringing your fears, you're bringing your hang-ups, and you're working to discard all of those in a group setting. And you have to trust each other to take care of one another in that setting.
Right.
And there's almost always in any improvisation, I mean, from new improvisators to really experienced ones, there's always tension. And you always watch people move through tension together. And I thought, how can we bring this into a group performance? How can we do this? And it kind of, it started in this, there was a small group of us who wanted to do a class together where we could practice this even more and really tie it into text, because text has been a really important medium for us to be using, like particularly in the Broadway reviews, right? Like the text was the inspiration for what we were doing. So we thought, okay, how can we tie in this really cool, these really cool rules of improvisation and text and worship. And so a few of us kind of designed this independent study that turned into a group of seven that Dr. Carr, David Carr, who I mentioned earlier, helped us, helped advise us, although he really let us, you know, lead each other. And we started meeting once a week. And we would do a meditation and a check-in, and we would sit in a darkened room with candles. If you're familiar with the Tze community, I think we took a lot of things, maybe unconsciously, from Tze. And we chanted text. We played with text. We danced to text. We drew text. We took photos. We did dramatic interpretations. And we all kind of galvanized around this free improvisational singing or soundscaping, I like to call, around these texts that we were doing. And just week after week, we were having these really, really incredibly deep religious experiences together.
And they were transformative.
Yes, they were so special because no one was preaching at anyone. We weren't discussing difficult things, but we were entering into this place of very deep intimacy and trust together. And we would get, you know, lost in these songs that we were creating for 20, 30 minutes. We'd open our eyes and we couldn't believe how much time had passed. And, you know, this may seem kind of like a new practice or even kind of like new age given our current context, but I think that there's something about this that's very, very ancient very, very tribal. And, you know, these texts were passed down for ages in oral, you know, musical tradition. So it's really maybe not even all that new. I think we're kind of tapping into something that has always been.
Wow.
And it's really, really special. And so we have this experience this semester, and we're, you know, kind of moving into next semester and thinking, okay, we want to do a performance, but how do we do, you know, how do we incorporate what we've learned? And also draw on the lessons of these past two productions, these past two Broadway review productions. And mm-hmm. it seems as though people really wanted to kind of get away from the straight performance of, you know, learn a song, perform it, you know, and keep the textual interpretation and the textual
right.
study, and also keep, hang on to these elements of improvisation that we were doing. And
right.
The text that we've decided to go with actually came out of this class that we have taken with a man by the name of Hal Taussig. And Hal recently edited and published a book called The New Testament, which is a collection of early Christian texts that were written around the same time as the Gospels and are just wild and wonderful to read and really refreshing and very much Christian.
But they're not included in the Bible.
Right. They're non-canonical. They're non-canonical texts. And as Hal says, we really don't know why. There isn't any necessary explanation as to why some of these texts ended up in the Bible and some of them didn't. I would imagine that a lot of it had to do with kind of patriarchal, priestly concerns about, you know, maybe women and minorities getting the wrong idea about who they were and who they could be in the world. And thank God the Gospels, still transcend those ideas. But some of these texts are really radical. Some of them are also very misogynistic. But the text that we're going to perform is called The Acts of Paul and Thecla. And so what's wonderful about that is that it's not very well known, and we aren't really necessarily fighting against any bad theology, in our current paradigm. We're kind of getting to just do something really, really new and really creative.
Right.
So the plan is to workshop this particular text, to spend some time with it using the same kind of improvisatory methodologies that we've been using over the last semester and that I learned over the last year, and come up with something that's kind of in between improvisational music and straight written music. So I think there will be some elements of the performance that are totally improvised, that have been composed and practiced. There will be elements that are very liturgical, very worshipful, that we will, give the audience the option to participate in. I think that we're hoping that it will be a really sacred, theatrical worship experience.
I think it's going to be wonderful. I'm so excited. And if we have listeners who are in New York, I encourage you to keep your eyes open for these I hope we do more than one performance, but I think it's going to be really exciting. And I'm thrilled to be a part of it, but I really can't wait for people to see how we can look at history and the Bible and how it applies to us today, and how it applies to artists. And so I appreciate you talking about that. I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to Spiritually Speaking with Reverend Jen and Rebecca. We're talking to Lindsay Nye, who is a student at Union Theological Seminary. And Lindsay, I wanted to make sure that we talked about, so not only are you like also doing this very, very intense performance art piece this year. But you, of course, have regular classes that you have to attend. And you took a class this semester on, and you'll have to tell us more about it, because I'll give you my limited knowledge of it. But on, it was a race relations type course. And can you tell us about the program that you came up with in that class dealing with race?
Sure, I'd love to. I should go ahead and just kind of say before I get into any of this that I'm really still learning a lot. I'm really new at talking about race and
mm-hmm.
learning about race.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just want to throw that out there that I'm by no means as qualified to speak on this as I am to speak about Broadway reviews.
I think it is important to acknowledge those things, especially in our current context. And so I appreciate you saying that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Well, there was a course offered this last semester. It was a Christian ethics course taught by this incredible woman, Sarah Azaransky, Dr. Sarah Azaransky. And the title was Sexual and Religious Legacies of Slavery. And I read the title, and there was something inside me that said, this is going to be really challenging, and you must do it. You must do it.
Right.
I should disclose, if you couldn't tell, that I'm a white woman.
Mm-hmm.
I come from a kind of liberal, upper middle class background, and I always kind of have thought of myself as like a good white person.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came to seminary and I really started to question, what does that mean? What does it mean to be a good white person? Is that really even possible? What does it look like? And could I be racist? And is this a possibility? Is this something that could be inside of me? So this was an incredibly difficult and powerful, powerful class. I never, ever have learned about slavery. I mean, I think, the things that I learned about slavery were, I could probably sum up in like a few sentences, right? Like that it was like this evil thing that America took part in. And, I have this image of plantation slavery as kind of being like what slavery looked like. A few names, Harriet Tubman. And I mean, but this
right.
is really, I mean, it's kind of a sham. Like, this is all I know, and I'm an educated liberal, and this is all I know about the history of
right.
slavery.
And
when I saw the words, the sexual and religious legacies of slavery, I thought, this is gonna be a class about how we can connect what's happening now to what
right.
happened several hundred years ago.
Wow.
And no one had ever connected the dots for me. And I had never even occurred to me to connect those dots. I think it's
right.
it's a very kind of popular go-to defense of primarily white people to say, oh, well, slavery's over. What's the big deal? Like, why are we still talking about slavery?
Right.
And so just the title of this course alone kind of gave me this, this is real, and I'm going to learn. And I did. We read so much. It was just, it's so incredible. And, just started off by learning about colonial slavery and
mm-hmm.
how really diverse that was. You had this plantation slavery that we're all familiar with, but there were just so many different degrees of freedom that slaves were given. Often slaves and white indentured servants kind of cohabitated or were in community with each other. There are slaves that wrote who were published in local newspapers. There were slaves who were doctors. I mean, it's so incredible. It's such a rich, rich history. I think I learned that, as much as anything else this past semester, that there's no one slave narrative. There's no one African American narrative. There's no one Black church. These people are as diverse as anyone else. And
Wow. Yeah.
You know, these, you know, I even like hate to kind of be like, I have this incredible insight, because it should seem so straightforward, right? But we're just,
mm-hmm.
we're very ignorant. I'm very ignorant.
Right.
You know, as I'm learning about all of this stuff, you know, I'm learning that we listened to this NPR piece about how people get jobs in America. And mm-hmm. people get jobs because they know someone in their workplace. That's like the vast majority of how people get jobs, is they're
right.
connected to someone in the workplace.
Right.
And guess what? The workplace has always been primarily, I mean, you know, and I'm not talking like labor class, but talking like professional class people. It's been predominantly white since slavery. And
yes.
that bubble has never been burst. And so here's this legacy of slavery, where we have this kind of impenetrable professional workforce, and where people are getting into it via, you know, personal recommendations from people they know. And then
right.
we have other studies coming out showing that most white people aren't even friends with black people. They have like no black friends.
Right.
So, you know, these patterns are, you know, started to emerge for me of like, wow, there are these systems that just have never once been questioned or broken for hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm.
This is the same with the healthcare system.
Right.
You know, you find doctors based on references. I mean, it goes on and on.
Right.
And it started to suggest to me, or started to kind of see, there's like this insanity behind it, right? Like it's so under our noses, but yet we're so ignorant to it, and we're systematically taught to be so
right.
ignorant to it, to the iniquities and the injustices. You know, until it takes something like someone being videotaped, being murdered, for people to really believe it, right?
Right. Right. Ooh,
and
yeah.
and this is insane behavior. And I'm really familiar with the 12 steps. I actually did 12 steps for codependence when
mm-hmm.
I was kind of going through my spiritual journey, because
mm-hmm.
I noticed that I was really finding a lot of my own value in other people,
mm-hmm.
which wasn't healthy for me. And so I did 12-step, which really, really helped me to recover from that and to
right.
move into a more spiritually and psychologically healthy place.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the rhetoric in 12-step is kind of around the insanity of addiction. And I started to think about whiteness and white racism. And, I take the very radical position that you cannot be white and live in this country and not be racist, whether you're conscious of it or not.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the fabric of who we
mm-hmm.
are. And to me, that's also kind of like addiction, you know, like you don't really choose it. It's a terrible thing. And it's kind of embedded within you, and it's your responsibility to address it and to use the 12 steps, you know, in the 12 steps, use the 12 steps to help recover from it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a really spiritual program. And, you know, we had a class where we were discussing reparations, and I don't need to go into the case on reparations, because there is so much material on the case for reparations, and everyone needs to educate themselves on why reparations need to happen,
uh-huh.
and why they're completely and utterly justified.
Right.
When people who were enslaved were freed, they were promised land by the government, and they never got
right.
it.
Right.
So there are some really, and then just like broken housing systems where, you know, people were being intentionally ripped off. People are being intentionally kicked out of communities. I mean, it's insidious. It's a really
yes.
insidious and evil, evil part of our history, and something needs to happen.
Right.
But there's kind
right.
of this issue, right? Like how, okay, even if your heart is in this place where you want to make reparations, is it very helpful to give, you know, just to give money to a community who is still a part of this systemically racist society that takes advantage and oppresses and marginalizes I mean, is that really changing anything long term to
right.
give people money to put back into that very system by which they're oppressed and by which we're
right.
all oppressed?
Right.
You know, something else has to happen. That's my opinion. Something else has to happen in addition to material reparations.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that a lot of scholars refer to as restorative justice, which
okay.
is kind of, you know, non, I think, and, you know, I said, I'm not an expert on this, but my
mm-hmm.
understanding is that this is kind of non-material reparations.
Okay.
These are spiritual reparations. And,
mm-hmm.
this, you know, this means that we need to have a spiritual awakening in this country. We need, particularly white people, we need to have a spiritual awakening and recognize the parts that we are playing in this system, even if they're very passively and unconsciously. We're all doing it, every single
yes.
one of us.
Yes.
And I kind of view it as this mass addiction, right? Like it's this insane compulsion that seems rewarding in the moment, that's actually quite damaging and quite dehumanizing to every party involved, oppressed and oppressor, right?
right?
Dehumanizes
right.
people.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I did was develop a 12-step program designed particularly for white people to address this issue. And the reason that I chose the 12 steps is because there are steps for making amends in the 12 steps. And it comes
right.
many, many steps after you do spiritual exploration of yourself, where you take moral inventory of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that part of this moral inventory is to learn, to read black writers, to read about systemic injustice and racial inequality.
Right.
This is our moral imperative, white America. This is our moral imperative to educate ourselves on these issues and to really take a very close look at ourselves and our systems. And I think that it really does start on an individual and small communal level, which is, you know, I learned that from my organizing days, which
mm-hmm.
is why I think the 12 steps are also very useful. So I imagined what if there were pockets of people all over the country doing 12 steps where they were really addressing their racism as though it were an addiction of the spirit. And I have no idea if it would work.
Right.
You know, it's just, but I wanted to put the idea out there because I think that the 12 steps has worked for a lot of people. There may be psychological, you know, methodologies that are more efficient. I'm totally open to learning about those. I'm not a psychologist. I'm a student.
I
would love to learn more.
But
just if people were just able to admit, you know, that first step to admit their powerlessness over this issue, that we just, white America just does not have the awareness and the knowledge to grapple with this yet, and that a step, you know, that these steps toward restorative justice and reparations and a new society can really only happen in conjunction with a spiritual awakening. That's my personal belief. You know, I think that this would be really useful.
I love that, and I think, you know, it's one of the things that I've learned, certainly coming to this very diverse academic institution, and then also just being around this type of these types of issues in the recent, you know, news and in our world today, is that, you know, to own and acknowledge your own racism is not a thing to be ashamed of,
mm-hmm.
because, like you say, it's something that we can't help it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that first step of understanding that this is just something that sort of we are indoctrinated in, and then working to, you know, combat it and come around in a different way is so important. But I think there's so much shame around especially I would say in upper class white America, or upper middle class white America. Nobody really wants to say that they're racist, because then that means that they must be a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
And
there's so much stigma attached to that word.
Yes,
and that's
yes.
one of the powers of 12 steps, right, is this kind of removal of stigma from addiction.
Yes.
And I just want to clarify, too, because it's really ambiguous wording that, like, that we can't help it. Like, I want to just really clarify that we can't help being born into this system, but we can help to change it, and we can
absolutely.
Help. To connect to ourselves and to each other and to undergo a spiritual transformation that is well within our power.
Thank you for making that distinction. That is very, very important. Well, I'm going to wrap us up right here. Lizzie, it has been so amazing to talk to you. And, I get to have, sort of social conversations with you, but, I'm proud to call you a colleague, and I really just love the work that you're doing. I cannot wait to see what you're going to do in the next few years. I think it's going to be phenomenal. And I think that I just also want to, say just like a prayer of thanks that someone like you was able to rediscover their artistic nature and was given that license and that permission by an academic, faith-based institution. That is just a unique story in itself, and I'm so grateful that you were given that opportunity to share what share your gifts with the world, but also to explore your own spirituality in your own space and time. So
thank you so much
for sharing
Rebecca.
That. Yeah, it's
thank
wonderful.
You. I had a really great time.
Good, and for our listeners, again, this was a pre-recorded show, so thank you so much for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks live to take your phone calls. And Lindsay and I, thank you so much. Everyone have a good evening and good night.
Thank you. Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas.